Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, hello, hello. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I want to welcome you to the Labrish this evening. It's a beautiful Thursday in my neck of the woods, and what I'd like to do is what I always do on a Thursday when we take a virtual trip to Jamaica, land we love. So if you will just be with me for a moment. We will virtually take that trip. First, we got to get rid of all the cares of the week because we have a saying on the island, no problem on. So we are going to relax in our favorite chair. If you have visited the island or grew up on the island, you know that comes this time of day, we have the trade winds blowing softly across your face. So we could be in the hammock, in the easy chair, under a mango tree, on the beach, on top of the roof, or wherever. But it's time to relax and chill. So this evening, as we always do, I am hoping to enlighten you about someone special from the past, because here in the backyard, when we labrish, we are always celebrating or enlightening or preserving the wonderfully rich culture that of Jamaica that we love. And although we may not be there planning to go back there, we really want to have great memories. So what I try to do each week is to do some research on some things we might not be familiar about, and I'm always so excited when I come up on a new story. And for those who might come by later, all the stories are archived on Blog Talk Radio, so you can just do a search within the Blog Talk, within the Backyard Labrish part of Backyard of Blog Talk Radio, and you will get to a subject that we have covered before. So we have been doing people of the past that have made a difference in other parts of the world. We had two wonderful stories the last 2 weeks about the Watsons, and then we did the Watsons family. So I'm hoping if you haven't listened to those shows yet, you will click on them at some other time, or if you're coming by later, make sure you check out the Watsons, because it's a great story that really made us proud. And I did not know about those people before, and I was so thrilled. So this tonight, I am going along with my guest co-host, I'm going to bring you the story of another Jamaican born that we might not know much about, but this is such an interesting past that he had. And I'm always looking for a hook or an anchor that can bring to light, you know, how much have changed over the years, but how much remain the same. We are all humans, and no matter whether we're rich or poor, born here or there, there's certain things that, you know, come out in our personality and in our history. And I'll be tying some of that together as I weave my way through the story. And I'd like to tell you that I was brought to the story by Dr. Joy Lumsden, who's one of my favorite historians. So I'm going to start. If you're on my list, you will know that we're discussing John Brown Russwurm, spelled R-U-S-S-W-R-M. So here I go, and my co-host for the evening is going to be talking. This is a very interesting story because this man was born in Jamaica, came to the United States, then ended up in Africa where he died. So his African venture is going to be told to you by our guest host this evening, who will introduce himself later on. But let me start with John. John Brown Russwurm was born in Port Antonio on October 1st, 1799. His father was an American of German descent who was doing business as a merchant in that town and probably owned property in the parish. His Jamaican mother, we know, was African, because there are different writers have described her to be, you know, working at different places or somehow, but we know for sure that she was African. Now, excuse me. Let me just tell you now that he lived in Jamaica until around 1807, which means that he was 8 years old when he left. But he presumably received some elementary education and then was sent to school in Quebec, Canada. Now, opinions seem divided as to whether his father also went to Canada with him or stayed in Jamaica. Be that as it may, this is from Dr. Lumsden's notes, which you can find all of this writing at Joyous Jam. If you just Google her, you will find her writings on this. And I'm going to be paraphrasing at times and putting in what I call my sidebar. So by 1912, so we know he was 8 years old when he was sent to Canada. By 1912, he's now 13. And both he and his father were located in Portland, Maine, with his father's Russwurm Sr.'s new wife, who was Susan Blanchard. Now, his stepmother was Susan, of course, insisted that her husband give him his family name, Russwurm, until then he was apparently known just as John Brown, which was his mother's name. John was also considered a part of the family long after he left home. He was sent to school at Herborn Academy in Herborn, Maine, a school which, unusual for its time, educated girls alongside boys, though, of course, they did not go to college. At Herborn, he worked hard to get a good education, never missing classes or getting into any trouble. His fellow students gave him the nickname Honest John. When he left Herborn, he taught for some time at what was later named the Abel Smith School for African American Children in Boston. In 1824, he was then 23. With help from his stepmother and William Hawks, which is her third husband because his father died. No, I think I skipped a part. Let me go back here. Susan Rushmore treated John as a son along with her children by her first marriage. So apparently she was married before she married his father. And after his father died in 1815, he was then 16 years old, and she married her third husband, William Hawes, spelled H-A-W-S. John was always considered a part of the family. That's the part I left out. Long after he left home. So he was sent to school by them to this Herborn Academy in Maine, a school which, unusual for its time, educated the girls alongside with the boys. But they didn't get to go to college. But he worked to get a good education, never missing classes. I love to stress these points so that they can be encouraging to the young folks who might come by and listen to this program. And also for us seniors that know the value of a good education. So let's get back to the story now. We know that he late taught at a school. So there he had a fellow while he was sent to, it's spelled B-O-W-D-O-I-N, but I looked it up online and it's pronounced, it's a French name, so it's pronounced Bodon, B-O-W-D-O-N. There he had as fellow students, and this really excited me, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and Nathaniel Hawthorne. And he was admitted to the Ephesians, the first college fraternity to admit an African American. He graduated with a bachelor's degree of art in September of 1826, and he delivered a class orientation at the commencement exercise. However, as a book of recollections of Baldwin at the time shows, social acceptance had very decided limits. Russ Warm, the first and only colored graduate of that college, up to 1893, which was 94 years after he graduated, they never had another graduate of color except in the medical department. He was a diligent student, but of no marked ability. He lived at a carpenter's house just beyond the village limits, where Hawthorne the writer and Horatio Bridge called upon him several times, but his sensitiveness on account of his color prevented him from returning the calls. Now, after leaving Bowdoin, Russ Worm settled in New York City, fitting easily into its population of well-educated free blacks. He soon earned a reputation as an articulate and courageous leader in the struggle against slavery. When an anti-slavery newspaper run by African Americans was under consideration, it was inevitable that he would be involved. So I want to now read to you his involvement in the newspaper, and then my guest tonight is going to tell you about his travels to Africa. But let me just tell you about the schoolmates who were calling on him, and he didn't really reciprocate because, you know, it's not everybody know. I'm just having pictures of him, and they're, if you're watching, if you're listening online, you will see a picture of him in the little flash presentation that you should be viewing right now. And if for those listening, calling in, if you want to see what he looks like, you can click on the show at any time after, and you will see, I'm sure, that the flash goes on then too. However, you know, I'm all this techie now, so I'm putting in pictures and all of that. So what I want to, this is my sidebar, folks, talk about a little now is the fact that I talk about things being, because we are humans, you know, even long ago, there were people who were considerate of other people. Because just think about this now. Here is this man with this, he's from German descent. He's an American, but he's doing business in Jamaica. And somehow he got with this African woman and have this child. He either takes the child, they're not sure, or the child goes before him at 8 to be schooled. He's schooled in Jamaica because in those days, apparently people were going to school early. We know that people from the old school, like me, know that we started with, you know, not pre-K as they call it here, but we were doing some serious twice ones are too. I'm sure some of the seniors can relate to that. And instead of drawing pictures and doing art, we were doing training the brain with some serious math and rhymes and, you know, putting words together. So I am just picturing that perhaps in the old days this went on all over, because they mentioned that he got an elementary education in Jamaica, and he was 8 when he left. So he went to Canada, perhaps with a fair amount of education. So he went to school there. Then shortly after his father married this woman who was married before with children, she insisted that he give this child his name because apparently he didn't have it before. And she welcomed him into the family with her 3 children. Then his father died when he's a teenager. She marries again, and he is part of that family. And you know, it seems almost unreal that this is happening in 18-something in Massachusetts, which, you know, even now, I have gone back to the school that he graduated from, and there's hardly, I'm sure there's, on the pictures I see, is not like it has a lot of people of color. So you can imagine, it states here, he was the only one. And up to 94 years after, he was the only one of that department, and there were perhaps 2 others in the medical field to graduate from the Bowdoin. So I thought that was worth some explanation. But let me tell you, I mentioned that Nathaniel Hawthorne was one of his schoolmates. Now, he was born in 1804, which made him younger than John, because John was born in 1799. And this man was famous, you know, very, very famous. So, and I'm sure everybody, I don't have to explain who Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was, and he is one of them that was calling on him after they left school. These 2 gentlemen also gave the commencement speech when they graduated, you know, so he was up there with them in terms of, I'm sure, how he articulated and just his level of intelligence. So now what I am going to do is to ask my co-host to put up his hand so that I can welcome him to the show, so he can help me to fill you in. But before I do that, I wanted to read a little bit about the newspaper that Dr. Lums then mentioned that he formed. And all of this, of course, is after he graduated and did his thing. So let me just give you some excerpts from the, it was called the Freedom Journal. And it was first published in 1827. And the first publication says, thus declare Samuel Cornish and John B. Rossworm on the front page of Freedom's Journal, the first African-American owned and operated newspaper published in the United States. The journal was published weekly in New York City from 1827 to 1829. Samuel Cornish served as co-editor with John B. Rossworm between March 16, 1827 and September of 18, and he resigned in September of 1827 to 1829. And then Cornish resigned after that. And Rossworm took the paper all over completely. Now, this Freedom Journal provided international, national, and regional information on current events and contained editorials declaiming slavery, lynching, and other injustices. The journal also published biographies of prominent African Americans and listings of births, deaths, and marriages in the African-American New York community. Freedom's Journal circulated in 11 states, the District of Columbia, Haiti, Europe, and Canada. Jamaica isn't mentioned here, so because I suppose we didn't have as many problems at that time as they had in these other places. The newspaper employed subscription agents. One of these was David Walker, and he has some reputation about writing some papers. So that's why he's been mentioned here. Now, Freedom's Journal was the first newspaper owned, operated, and edited and published by people of color. It was born on the 16th of March, 1827, and was published at 5 Varick Street, which was demolished. The place he started was demolished in 1980 in New York City. The senior editor was the Reverend Samuel E. Cornish, minister of the First Negro Presbyterian Church in New York. The junior editor, John Brown Rossworm, this is from Wikipedia, by the way. That was him, John Brown Rossworm. Slavery was finally abolished in the state of New York on July 4th of the same year, 1827. Freedom's Journal actually was quite popular. It ran a weekly, and the subscription was $3 with a discount for payment in advance. Like most other papers, Freedom's Journal sometimes had to put on pressure to get its readers to pay up the subscriptions. You know, what I tell you is that a lot remains the same. The paper carried some advertisements at 75 cents for 12 to 22 lines. Boy, things were cheap in those days. Rossworm used this means to advertise his evening school. Apparently, he had an evening school. There's not a lot of information about that. The weekly circulation was around 800, and there were a number of agents along the Eastern Seaboard and in Canada, Haiti, and the United Kingdom to sign up new subscribers and renew subscriptions. When Cornish resigned as editor in September of 1827, he continued to assist by organizing the the agent systems. The paper, again, like many others, also did job printing, presumably on its own press. The mission of Freedom's Journal had a number of aspects. It was to counter the pro-slavery press and misrepresentations and slander about the African American population in general. The free African American and newly freed slaves were to be encouraged to improve themselves by education, hard work, thrift, self-reliance, and claiming their rights as citizens, in addition to marriage and death notices, items of local and foreign news. The paper carried feature stories and articles geared towards personal improvement, including accounts of the lives of African Americans such as Phyllis Wheatley and Paul Coffey, and always the opposition to slavery and every type of crime against both slaves and free men. Isn't that a wonderful passion and story? So I am just, as usual, always excited to bring to life. I call myself reading the story as bringing all of this historian's message or work, giving it a voice. So right now I see that my assistant tonight has his hand up, and I'm going to open the mic and welcome him. So here I go. Good evening. We've got Margaret in the backyard.
This is Lay in the Bronx. And we are having a thunderstorm at the moment. It looks like we may have even worse than the thunderstorm shortly. So bear with me.
Okay. Well, welcome to the backyard.
Yep. I think it brought us up to maybe about 1828 after Rush Worm's co-editor resigned, right?
Right. And I gave a little detail of what the paper was all about, really.
I see you did. And at that point where his co-editor resigned, Rush Worm took a little turn in a direction that seems to find him getting involved in the Back to Africa movement.
And if
you notice, we know a lot about the Back to Africa movement through Marcus Garvey, of course, but we really never heard of Rushmore, John Brown Rushmore.
I was just about to ask you if you had ever heard of this man.
No, I have not. And, of course, he gets credits from the American side because he was here. He was born 88 years before Marcus Garvey anyway.
Right.
And Marcus Garvey was promoting pretty much the same thing when he came on the scene, 88 years later.
Right. But it's ironic that both of them, you know, ended up in New York or started out in New York.
Yes,
because
even
though this man was educated in Maine or Massachusetts between those two, he ended up in New York.
Well, that seemed to be where the action is, and he was relying on the support of some prominent men of that period, to espouse his cause and to help him to promote the idea of sending people back to Africa. Now, as he started to turn in this direction and to support the ideas of the Back to Africa movement emerged this colonial colonization society. And the colonization society are people who were agreeing with the idea of sending people
going back to Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for some people, they were staunch believers that it would better the cause of the slaves or black people, because slavery was just the emancipation of slavery was just about 1863, so we're way ahead of the curve here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the
what I think that his idea was that it would be better to go elsewhere, away from the racism and discrimination inherent in the American society at the time.
Exactly right.
You know, because they couldn't be free. They were free, but not free.
Yes, and they as you mentioned before, there were a lot of lynching
going on even after the slavery was, you know, over.
Yes, and so it seems apparent that maybe he should promote this cause.
It was a good idea at the time.
And so, through the colonization societies, developed this Back to Africa movement, and it gained full steam through this movement. In other words, people were now going over to Africa in the thousands.
Mm.
And
what part of Africa?
Primarily, well, this is interesting because through this whole little scenario emerged Liberia. And
you mean it wasn't
Liberia,
there before?
Pardon?
Liberia wasn't there before?
No. Well,
really?
It might have been there before, but now it's going to gain prominence because you remember the idea of colonizing
West Africa, right?
It is.
Okay.
And the idea of colonizing people to start their own little projects. You
right,
know,
but
when they,
I'm sure
when
there
they,
were people there before.
There were people there before, but these were people there are Africans. Now we're getting
Americans that were Africans.
13. Well, they're not necessarily Africans, but they're of African descent, and
mm-hmm. Okay.
The claim was that they would have a better life there in these little colonizing segments of Africa. And
right, I hear them referred to here as African Americans.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the movement, out of this movement emerged this colony at the time of Liberia.
Right.
So this went on, and it apparently was successful during the lifetime
of. What did they do? What did the colonies?
Yes.
In
Africa, in the Republic of Liberia, it was a very successful project until.
What was the project? Did they organize schools, hospitals? What they did?
Well, they if you picture a village just starting out, they would have elders, and they would establish schools, and they would have formal, you might even call it lessons in farming, you know, as existed in the U.S. And some of these people that were there, who had come over, brought with them, you know, expertise, if you would call it that.
Skills.
I mean, in different areas. So this was a good, for the most part, a revolutionary process. But Ross Worm died, and the whole process took a turn for the worse. In other words, people who were maybe involved in it saw the opportunity for themselves to capitalize on some of the things that John Brown had introduced. So the whole colonization movement subsided for a while. Now, if you picture that this is a process that started in 1828, around 1828, 1829, and subsided for a while and started up again by other people, and then even our own Marcus Garvey started up another idea that we should send Africans to Africa.
No, was he thinking of the same part of Africa? I don't remember the story. I know we did it, but was he, Marcus Garvey, did he identify the part of Africa he would be going to?
Probably not. I mean, the foundation was already laid in Liberia, so I'm not sure that he got that far as to choosing another location.
Right.
I'm talking about Marcus Garvey and doing the same thing. But his ideas of the same idea was promoted by him, and I don't think he was as successful in making any headways into the return of many people to Africa. I know from, and you probably do too, your own experience or your own remembrance of what went on with Marcus Garvey. We didn't get the idea that he was successful in this situation.
Right. Well, we did his story. His story's online, you know, but I've done so many stories that sometimes I can't keep up with it. But I just want to tell the listeners, let me just take a break to tell listeners that may come by later or on the line now or listening online or calling in that you're listening to Backyard Labrish on Blog Talk Radio. We're here each Thursday night at 8 o'clock where we'll always have a subject that hopefully we hope will interest you. Several subjects that we've discussed in our archives and encourage you to check them out. So we want to thank you for being here. And back to you, Leigh.
Yeah, well, if you think of it in a way that, you know, the causes that were promoted Ross Worm's time was almost the beginning of civil rights as we know it, because when the slaves were freed, they a lot of people who had slaves were upset, of course. You know, we had a civil war resulting as a when this happened, and people were very upset with Lincoln and those days.
Right, right. We know, but you know what I'm thinking. I'm wondering if in any of the papers that Marcus Garvey did, if he knew about this man. It's just that is.
Well, I would say he must have known because.
Not necessarily. Remember, they didn't have the internet then.
Well, true, but
we know this because of the internet.
Yes, yes. But
that's why we know it. That's why
we know a lot about Hawthorne, and we know about his other pal, was he Woodsworth?
Right, because they were really famous.
Well,
they were really famous.
Well,
he was in good company when he was in school because there was another name mentioned, and he was a commodore of some big Navy ship. And he was his friend, too.
Sure. So, you know.
And what is amazing to me, Leigh, is that this man was obviously, it's not that he could pass. He wasn't light skin. He was brown.
Well, that may be so. But he academically, he was very competent. And we don't know as we speak if he got as much credit as was doing due to the fact that he was a black man and he...
Well, that's what I am saying, that these people were his friends.
Well,
because they were trying to seek him out when he was in apparently not responding to them.
Well, I'm not sure if there were... Some were his friends, of course, but there were other people that had an axe to grind because they wanted the black man out of here.
Well. I'm just talking about what I read here,
yeah.
And the three that were mentioned in this that were calling on him was Longfellow. The other guy, and there's a, I forgot his name now. I'll look up my notes. And
but
he was Commodore, that was some big person in the Navy, and blah, blah, blah.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't read that.
And that is before. That is
Longfellow and called on him for any of these projects that he started. You know, it was...
No. That is while he was in college. He got a master's, you know. He had a master's degree from that university.
Yes.
And I want to go on to say that in 1978, that university, the Bowdoin, named a center after him in his honor.
Yeah.
So he has gotten, you know, some claim. We just didn't know that he was heard of him or knew he was born in Jamaica, of a Jamaican mother.
Yeah.
But he has been recognized in the American community a lot, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring him to life in the Jamaican community.
Yeah.
But there is a center named after him, and that was done in 1978. So that's fairly recent, you know, in our time.
So some people had heard of him and brought his name.
Oh, the college that he graduated from named one of the houses there after him. So it perhaps, and this is in Massachusetts.
Yeah,
I said we never hear of him.
Yeah.
And his Jamaican connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, anyway, tell us some more about what happened in Africa.
Well,
how long did that operation last?
Until John Brown's death.
Oh, I got you.
And then it subsided, but it started up again after, due to the fact that this colonization movement continued. And this is why I say that some people wanted this project to continue.
Right. Well, Marcus Garvey certainly wanted it to
be... Yeah, I mean, aside from Garvey, certain, and I mentioned certain people had an axe to grind. They wanted this to continue because they wanted, they didn't want the African American to succeed in the same way that they were previously due to this, our friend John Brown.
Right, I got
you. And it's a sort of a contradiction, but that's, if, when you really look into it, that's what the people wanted to achieve. I mean, you said before that certain things never change. Just
right, right. Well, you know, because on the backyard here, we just try to accentuate the positive.
Yeah.
Because I think as humans, the humans all over the world from time immemorial, is so flawed. And but that's why I say, you know, things change and some things remain the same.
I didn't want to really go too far into this because then you would see the other side of the issue.
And what I'm saying is, for me right now, I never knew about him before, and I am looking at the part where, you know, here is this little black boy. Let's call him that. He was just John Brown. But his father decided that, I suppose, this is my child. I'm going to do something about it. And remember, his father was an American.
Yeah, well, he was prompted by
Not before. He never met the woman yet.
Okay.
He never met the woman yet. He took him to Jamaica, to Canada.
Yeah, he saw where
he put him in school in Canada. It's after that, he was 13. It's after that he met this other woman with three children and married her. No, it doesn't say if that was his first marriage. You know, sometimes in the historical documents, you get bits and pieces. You just have to sort of put it together. So I'm
putting my
own twist on it.
I saw where, you know, he graduated. Before he graduated, what was going on after the graduation was that Lincoln had made the emancipation document, you know,
what
this document where he made an executive order to eradicate slavery. And all this was going on, almost the same time, you might say, as the groundwork that was laid by guys like Cornish and
that man was a minister. He's Reverend Cornish.
Reverend Cornish, and
was the first minister of this black church in Harlem.
Yes, and the good guy.
So he identified with black people because
although he went to
a white university.
The good guys that helped Rushworm along weren't they Quakers?
The society, the one that started the society, the colonization society?
Yeah.
I think you have the documents on that. I didn't, but I believe I glanced over that they were Quakers.
Yeah, they had. The point I'm making is that they had, they were giving him encouragement to do this from a different point of view.
And those are the ones who started the organization. The thing is that Rushmore and Cornish, that's what they wanted because there were so many problems within the society in New York at the time and all this lynching going on.
I mean the country at the time.
Yeah, they were in New York predominantly. That's where he started the paper. The paper was in New York,
You said the lynching going on, and then you said
no. But they were writing about it. they were writing about it because they were aware of it. But, you know, I find it so interesting. They even had their own building. They used to print in their press. It gave the address. And the building was just demolished in 1980. Isn't that amazing? Hello? Leigh, are you there? Hello? Are you there, Leigh? Hello? Hello? Apparently, can anyone tell me if they can hear me? Because I know that our co-host said there was bad weather in his neck of the woods. So can 973-373 just hit 1 on your telephone? You don't have to speak, but just hit 1 and let me know if you can hear me. The mic
Hello?
Is open. Can you hear me? 646? Oops. Well, I guess 646 can hear me. So, Leigh, are you there?
I had just lost you. I thought you were having problems.
Yes, you were blank for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
Come back.
You had made a point. Where did we go on that? I'm sorry.
Well, actually, I was trying to find you, so I asked one of our listeners to... I thought I was off the air and you couldn't hear me, so we got that clarified. But I just wanted to say, you know, like in any period, you always want to have a part of the society that want to do one thing and think that is the best thing for them, and there's another part of the society or the population that think something else is better. So what I gathered from what I read from this story, that he felt, along with his supporters, that the people from African descent would have a better opportunity to live a life free from harassment and, you know, the possibility of being lynched if they were back in their own country, even though they were born in America. And that was his idea behind this whole Back to Africa movement. And from what I think I glanced over, they did go there. I think they made peace between some tribes. Wasn't there some mention of that?
I'm sorry, I didn't
hear you.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said, didn't he help to make some peace between some tribes in the area that they settled?
I am not aware of that.
I think I read that in my notes, that they were able to, because there were people there. There were Africans living there.
Yeah, it might very well be because he seemed to have organized the people in a fashion that they had not been before organized.
Right, right. And he was also appointed governor for a period.
Yes.
And he married and had children there and died there. All of that happened in Africa. But before he died, I read in my notes that he brought his sons back to America. So they went to Yarmouth, or is that North? I think Yarmouth University, which is still, it's going to be celebrating its 200th birthday on 2014. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And it mentioned in the notes that he still had, although his father was dead, he was very close with his African-American brothers, but he was still close and accepted by his white stepmother.
Right.
Because it's she and her husband who sent him to college. And we're talking, it was 18-something. And I think, you know, those are the points that I really want to break out, because in all of this hate and, you know, being so unkind to people because they were different, you had pockets of people who were the opposite. because you can't imagine her wanted to bring him up with her children that she had from a previous marriage. Then she go and get a third husband and tell him, well, I don't know if she told him, but between both of them, they're the ones that sent him to college because his father died like 3 years after he got married to her.
Mm-hmm.
So I just find those parts of the story, for me, the most interesting. Because, you know, the human interest part of it, because sometimes even the people that may be forced, because they're forced. I'm reading now about the children in Africa that are forced to be soldiers and kill people. You know, they don't really want to do that, but they're being forced to do it. So my point is that there are people with a heart in every situation. There are people who extend kindness to other people. And in all of history, we find that. And I want to use those points to encourage the listeners that we as citizens now, regardless of what's happening around us, have a responsibility to extend that. That is how I believe we can achieve immortality, to leave some good by doing good for somebody else. It doesn't have to be our personal children. It doesn't have to be any of that. But we have a responsibility to, if we feel that way. You see what I'm driving at? So I like to point that out, especially in these stories, when I stumble on them. So I was really quite excited about sharing John Brown, and to be a little comical and light about all of this. You know, we used to have a little song about John Brown, baby, has some coal upon his chest. Perhaps it might have been a girl song. I wonder if anybody on the board remembers hearing that or singing that when we were growing up in Jamaica. And he rubbed it with the camphorated oil. So when I saw the name John Brown, and I do know from other historical things I did about Jamaica, that in the early days, when a child was registered, it could be registered with the mother's name, not necessarily the father's name.
True.
So in this case, apparently he was registered, his mother's name was Brown, the last name, and he was registered with his name, her name, because he was known as John Brown until he went came to Massachusetts, where this woman insisted that the new husband she had give the child his name. That's how he comes to be Russ Worm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I find that very
interesting. I think I read where he did he had some influence in Haiti as well.
His publication, I don't know anything. He had agents in Haiti, and also his publication was sent to Haiti. I wonder how they got it there. In those days, they only had ships, right?
Yeah.
Apparently, they had to send it by boat. I'm sure it wasn't pigeon carrier.
Well, they got it there.
Beg your pardon?
I said, well, they got it there, you know.
Yeah. I'm always curious about, you know, the transportation and how people got around. Just imagine him leaving from America to Africa to go there to do his thing. I mean, I'm sure he didn't come from there. You know, his mother apparently came from there, or her mother. They're not sure whether he was born into slavery or not. His birth thing is sort of vague. They do know that his mother was African, but they're not sure whether she was in slavery when he was born or she was a free black. So, but one thing I want to be light, and as we're talking about coming up to the Olympics and all of that. But this, it mentioned about his early education. And I know he must have been with his mother, so you know he was getting some of the Jamaican food, which I'm sure would make him quite smart, perhaps much smarter than if he was born here and getting some food here.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you're not laughing. This is elaborate. It's not CNN.
You didn't hear because, no, I mean, the Jamaican diet in the old days must have had something to do with the quality of its products. The Jamaican fellows, people that succeeded and was prominent wherever they went, and showed a lot of gumption.
Okay, because what I'm thinking that, you know, he wasn't really born here, and I think being born and having his elementary education in Jamaica certainly laid the foundation for what went on after.
Well, although he wasn't born in this country, he certainly had enough of fight in him to go. In his papers, you know, the Freedom Movement papers, he had his ideas were outstanding for a person that was not born here, but understood what the slavery was from the American point of view.
Right, right. That's what I mean. He identified with them. It's not like because he had a white half that he was not identifying with who he was. That's some of the points that I wanted to bring out. You know, he was not trying to pass or trying to pass things over. He was himself. He was himself, but he had a passion for justice and education and what is right from wrong. So, you know, that's why I want to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Lumsden for bringing him to my attention so that I can bring it to the fans' attention and to celebrate him. And I am sure that some of his descendants are all over the place because, you know, he had three children. I don't know if they were sons, but it would be interesting for some, you know, I did a show once and some great grandson, it was about something in Port Antonio, did get in touch with me and sent me a picture. So I am hoping that if there are any worms out there that may be somehow tied to this gentleman, that they will at least let me know. So, Lay, do you have any, believe it or not, the time goes by when you're having fun in the backyard, but it's 9:03 already. Do you have any statements? Sidebars?
Except to say that, you know, it's a long time since all of this went down. It's over 150, 170 years even. So,
I'm sure he didn't realize that we would be talking about him now. I want to make a sidebar here and a plea to the seniors that if it was not for the power of the internet, I would not come across this because, you know, I would not even know about the historian's documentation because I'm not doing a thesis or I'm not, you know, researching things like that. And the average person don't have time. And some people, you know, would not take the time.
On the other hand, I just read the line where the John B. Russworm House in Portland was owned by a family and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places.
Yes.
So it seems evident that somebody knew about him and that...
Oh, a lot of people knew about him. We just didn't know about him as Jamaicans.
And treated him as a hero.
Yes. I was not implying that at all when I said people didn't know about him.
I know. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that somebody in Jamaica knew about him because here is the house that he lived in is in the National Historic Register. That's
in Jamaica?
Yes.
In Jamaica. He lived in a house
Portland,
in Jamaica.
Portland, Jamaica.
In where?
Portland.
Really?
Yes.
I am sorry. I didn't know you were saying Jamaica.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
That's
the point I wanted to make.
Thanks for pointing that out.
Now, don't forget also that he went to university in New England, you know. Now,
mm-hmm.
New England, in those days, New England was a pretty rough town because until Paul Revere came and exposed certain things.
Right, that's what I'm saying. He overcame all of that.
Exactly.
He surely did. And now there is a department at the Bowdoin that's named after him.
There too, you know. So he's mm-hmm. gaining recognition almost on the order of those famous classmates of his.
Right.
Almost.
Almost. And, you know, they too had it. Some of them were, you know, rich. But some of them weren't. When I was reading about them, you know, they had to move in with other people and all of that when times were hard. So it's part of what I would like some of the listeners to think about is that especially the younger folks that have a goal to achieve that is not always going to be easy. And people that we consider famous now or heroes never always had it easy. They had to overcome a lot of obstacles in order to live their passion or to pursue their dreams. So I hope that these stories will encourage them that it was happening, it has happened, and I'm sure it will continue to happen.
Yep.
Because, you know, although everything is so modern and we have so much technology, there's still difficulties in the world that people have to overcome in order to achieve. So a lot has changed and a lot remained the same. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And the thing about these guys, the people that you have been talking about for the last few weeks, including Mr. John Brown, they were trailblazers. I mean,
mm-hmm.
they initiated things. They were the only ones there, and they excelled. And now we're remembering them in that light.
Yeah,
so,
he was the first person of color to be indoctrinated or in whatever you call it. To a fraternity. When he was in college getting his master's.
Well, that in itself, I can tell you, is not an easy feat because.
And I'm sure there was no black.
It was worse then because nowadays there's so much criteria, especially in those kinds of schools. That you know, people don't even bother trying to get into these fraternities because it's so difficult. There are so many obstacles to overcome before you can be a member.
I want to say again that he was the only colored graduate of the Bowdoin College for 94 years.
And made
in the medical department. I think there were two in the medical department.
And made a graduation speech, don't forget.
Right. Made a graduation speech in 1826. But the interesting thing is that he was older than the Longfellow guy and the other guys.
You
the
like
Maurice
that point,
guy
huh?
And the Commodore guy. And he was talking to them.
Yeah,
was giving the speech to all of these. I don't know if the undergraduates were at the speech thing, but I know from this, brother, I can see that he was the only person of color. So they must have been talking to all white. And that, that is remarkable. Just remarkable. And although he seemed to have been a little shy, but, you know, it's obvious that he he got a lot more confidence in himself. So for all you shy ones out there, I just encourage you to keep working on becoming more confident about your talents, your gifts, your dreams, and your goals. And with that said, I'd like to invite anyone on the board that would like to weigh in the labyrinth to put his one on your phone.
Okay, go ahead.
So that I can know that you would like to join us, because we're going to be going off the air in a couple of minutes. So I will be waiting to see the little hand go up as if you're in school, and to remind you that each week we try to research a subject that we can that can help us celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And I just want to take a minute to say that there are several other wonderful websites that are doing current events and keeping you all up with what's going on there now. But we're not one of them. We tend to dig up history about Jamaica or Jamaicans that you might not know, including me, and I don't know about Lay, but including me. A lot of this is all new to me.
What I would say, Margaret, is if your listeners, any one of them, has a person or knows of some historical event that happened way back when and it wasn't in our history books, maybe they could bring it forward and discuss it on this program.
Please do. We'd love to have you. And it doesn't even have to be so far long ago, because I did a program on the first person of color to be on the a Canadian stamp, and it happens to be a Jamaican. Her name was Rosemary Brown. Leigh, I don't know if you heard that, but that was one of my research projects, and I'm sure that perhaps a lot of Canadians know about it, but I didn't know if Jamaicans in the diaspora knew that the first person of color on a Canadian stamp was Rosemary Brown, who was born and raised in Jamaica. So you can check that show out also. It's in the archives. And, you know, over the years, Leigh, we have just covered so many subjects. You know, our exotic fruits, when the different ethnic groups came to Jamaica, the 14 parishes. We did a series called Discover Jamaica, One Parish at a Time, and we did all 14 parishes. And I remember that being just so interesting. We did our mineral springs, and we've just done some very wonderful enlightening shows. So
you can find those programs, right? You could
in the archives. You just go, if you just Google Blog Talk Radio or Backyard Labrish, if you go to Backyard Labrish, you will find the Blog Talk Radio icon over on the right. You just click on that. You can listen to the current show. You can search for a special show. You can put in a keyword and get a show that would be relevant to the word you're searching. So we encourage you to get a little creative. And I also ask you, if you listen to a show that has tweaked your interests and you have a friend or a list of friends who would you think would enjoy it, you all you have to do is copy the URL, the website address of that particular show, and mail it to send it to them in their email, and they can listen to that show. They don't have to search or anything, but they'll get directly to that show. So with that said, I want to thank you for being. We have a lot of loyal fans because our numbers are really going quite fast. We don't have perhaps as many calling in as I'd like, but by the next day, our shows have been.
That's not what I heard. Somebody told me, a little bird had told me that you had a composite of a certain figure, which you probably should disclose to people.
Oh, thanks for reminding me. Some time ago, and I cannot remember the exact date, and for the fans that might come by that are new, I call myself a senior's senior. So that may give you a little idea of the age group. So I'm not as picky as I would like to be, I'm planning to be, because I can't talk. We have a chat room, and I'm not able to chat and figure and do the board and broadcast at the same time. But I'm working on that. However, some time ago I mentioned that I would like to hit 50,000 downloads in celebration of Jamaica's 50th independence. And I am glad to say, by the help of everyone who's listening to the show, telling other people about the show, with their help, we have already hit that, and we're not yet at the Independence Week. So I want to thank you. I am really honored.
So that's 50,000 people.
I am very grateful.
50,000 have called in, right?
No. It's not a call-in. It's that have listened collectively.
When you say hit, what does that mean?
A hit means that, and the radio, Blog Talk Radio, is the one who keeps track of this, that people have actually listened to the show that many times, all the shows collectively.
Okay.
That's a hit. Mm. And when the callers in are part of that count, I think. They're part of that count to make, not necessarily, no, perhaps not. But these might be people listening online, or it could be a combination of both. I'm not quite sure. But I thought that having the 50,000 downloads in celebration of the 50th independence would be really something that would make my day. So I want to thank everyone for making my day. And, of course, I want to thank the historians that have contributed to the show so much, really. And I will look forward to seeing everyone next week at 8 o'clock here in the backyard when we get together to Labrish, and we are here to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica. Lay, will you join me?
Land we
love. And you notice the love with a lot of passion. So with that said, I'd like to end it like I always do and encourage you to make it a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Mr. Nunez.